From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, efforts to improve airport security. China flexes its diplomatic muscles. And why gourmets are heading to Syria. This week, the Obama administration named 14 countries of interest whose citizens will be subject to extra intense screening before they're allowed on flights to the United States. The new rules are in response to the attempted bombing of a Northwest Airlines jet on Christmas Day. A young man from Nigeria has been charged with that crime. To gauge reactions to the new security measures, we sent NPR reporters to airports in three countries, Iraq and Nigeria, which are on the list, and Italy, not on the list, but a key European transit point for travellers en route to the United States. We begin in Nigeria.
This is Ofebi Ekwistarkton, and I've come to Nnamdi Azikiwe International Airport in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to see whether these new tighter security and screening measures, A, have come into operation, and B, what Nigerians travelling to the US and other places think about the enhanced security. Right ahead of me is departure C, and I'm just going to talk to the passengers to see what they think about the tighter new security. Sir, your name, please.
My name is Basi Ben. I live in Columbus, Ohio, but I'm visiting Nigeria. I think sometimes you need to take a balance between security and freedom, and it seems at this point in time, security kind of trumps out freedom, and it's kind of inconvenient, but it's worth it. I hope the American government tries to find a balance without making every Nigerian seem responsible for what that little guy did.
My name is Nella Andem Ewa, and I'm a legal practitioner. I think it's very offensive. As a matter of fact, I'm embarrassed for America to isolate Nigeria for a singular offense, when what they should be doing is to place the blame where it ought to be. Because if the father of a child felt that there was need to report the unusual behavior of his son, and obviously there was a lapse somewhere.
So what's your message to President Obama?
Actually, he was number one on my list. I mean, I used to be his fan, but I'm beginning to question who he is really. And what he stands for. I'm beginning to question it because he should have thought better and asked more questions and placed the blame where it ought to be and found out where the loopholes were. Is it that he can treat Nigeria as he wishes with his left hand? I'm embarrassed for him.
So will you be travelling to the US in the future, ma'am?
I couldn't be bothered to go there because I wouldn't be insulted, certainly not. Thank you.
And that's the view from Nigeria. For NPR News, this is Ofebi Ekwistarkton reporting from Abuja International Airport.
This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome, where Fiumicino Airport is one of Europe's key hubs to the United States. But at this security checkpoint, there are few visible signs of stepped-up screening as passengers walk through metal detectors. Susanna Coppola is one traveler not in favor of body scanners. I don't think we need to go so far to examine passengers, she says. We're bombarded with scare stories, she adds. That's what makes us scared of flying. Another traveler, Giuseppe Mancini, has fewer qualms.
È meglio la sicurezza, la privacy.
It's better to have security, he says. Privacy can take second place. But these Americans, he adds, are always asking an awful lot from us. Within 2 or 3 months, Rome, Milan, and Venice airports will be equipped with full-body scanners for people traveling to the U.S., Britain, and Israel. Interior Minister Roberto Maroni announced today.
Security comes first, before everything else for those who fly, and body scanners will be installed in compliance with health and privacy requirements.
But meeting in Brussels today, European aviation officials were divided. Belgium's Secretary of State for Transport, Etienne Schoop, said such enhanced measures are excessive, adding that he felt Americans are exaggerating and that security controls in most European airports are strict enough. Spain also expressed skepticism, while the French government remains uncommitted. Germany has posed three conditions before scanners can be deployed: that they increase security, that they pose no health risks, and that they don't harm an individual's rights. Some European security analysts question the effectiveness of body scanners, saying the attempted attack on the Christmas Day Amsterdam-Detroit flight was a failure of intelligence, not lack of technology. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
I'm Quill Lawrence in Baghdad. This isn't the sound of Baghdad International Airport. In fact, this isn't even the parking lot outside Baghdad International Airport. It's the parking lot about a quarter of a mile away, where most people traveling to the United States or anywhere outside Iraq have to get out of their cars, unload their bags, and get into an airport-approved shuttle bus. Baghdad Airport might be the most elaborately secured commercial airport in the world, not least because it's surrounded by one of the biggest U.S. military bases in Iraq. As such, there really isn't much to do to increase security here. Every single person that makes it even to the airport lounge has been ID'd, metal detected, physically searched, and had their bags set out in a row to be sniffed by a German shepherd. Ali Abu Tahir is on the way to Amsterdam with his son. He says it doesn't bother him to spend extra time getting to the airport. The road out to the airport used to be one of the most dangerous in Iraq. It's now considered relatively safe. And once inside, the extra measures can provide a rare sense of, well, security. Khadim Rahim works here loading suitcases. Baghdad is pretty good these days, says Rahim, but when I get past this checkpoint, I finally feel safe. In fact, for Iraqi civilians, coming to the airport might actually relieve stress. There are still no direct flights from Baghdad to the United States, so Iraqis will most likely notice any changes in U.S. security on the next leg of their journey. But again, that sort of special treatment is nothing new. In fact, the flights leaving here for some major airports, like Dubai or Istanbul, already land at a special terminal with an extra special layer of security checks for planes coming from Iraq. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Baghdad.
This year, China is likely to replace Japan as the world's second largest economy, and it's already replaced Germany as the world's biggest exporter. For some foreigners, it might be tempting to think that China is no longer a developing country, or that even that China is now a superpower. But as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing, in terms of its influence in world affairs, China is punching well above its actual weight.
It's a common news item these days, foreign emissaries traveling to Beijing to seek its cooperation on some global issue. Take something like emissions cuts. Tsinghua University economist Hu Angang says that as goes China, so goes the world.
China will be at the core of the global trend of emissions reductions. China already accounts for a fifth of humanity. And in the future, China will account for 40 to 50% of the increase in new emissions. That's why the whole world is so concerned about when China's emissions will peak.
In other words, because of its sheer size, China's importance in world affairs has outstripped its level of development or its capabilities. It's become a key global player without either the wealth or military muscle of a superpower. Beijing's response to foreign concerns has been to emphasize that it is still a developing country with limited means. In a recent interview with state media, Premier Wen Jiabao explained why development would remain China's priority. A huge population, big regional differences in development, and widespread poverty, he said. This is still China's basic situation. So is China still a developing country? Well, it is and it isn't, says Tsinghua's Hu Angang. For one, he argues, economic disparities among China's regions are too great to generalize about the whole country. And he says the situation is too complex to use one measurement. China's per capita economic output, for example, isn't even among the top 100 nations. But Hu says it's a totally different picture if you factor in health, education, and the purchasing power of the local currency.
In 1982,
most Chinese were living in third or fourth world conditions. By 2006, a third of Chinese were living at first world standards, two-thirds were at second-world standards, and only Tibet was in the third world.
Hu predicts that by these broader measurements, two-thirds of Chinese will be living at developed world levels in a decade. Analysts believe this is likely because China is in an economic growth spurt that could last for years. Part of this developmental phase is a ravenous appetite for energy, resources, and consumer goods. China Academy of Social Sciences climate expert Pan Jiahua says that as a latecomer to energy markets, China feels like it's attracting an unfair share of scrutiny.
When China goes somewhere to obtain oil or natural resources, it draws a lot of international attention. This doesn't happen to U.S. or European countries. What we're doing is normal, but some people in those countries feel that we're stealing their resources.
China's leadership realizes that the current phase of development carries big risks of social inequality and unrest. Many scholars say that lowering these risks requires political reform. But that's something for which, critics say, Beijing's appetite has been less than robust. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, one city's centuries-long love affair with food.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The Syrian city of Aleppo is one of the oldest cities in the world. It's also, thanks to fertile farmland and its location on ancient trade routes, the gourmet capital of the Middle East. Now Aleppo is getting the attention of Western food tourists, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The romance begins at the outdoor food markets. Radishes as big as apples, fresh white cheese bobbing in milky water, shiny olives, hundreds of pickles, and thick pomegranate molasses. Then there's the spice markets, with yellow turmeric, pink rose petals, and red sun-dried pepper pastes. This city, surrounded by olive, nut, and fruit orchards, is famous for a love of eating. The cuisine, a product of fertile land and location, along the Silk Road, an ancient trading route.
Thanks to this melting pot of caravans, which took place in Aleppo especially, all kinds of produce, fresh and preserved, used to pass by Aleppo.
That's Pierre Antaki, head of the Syrian Academy of Gastronomy. The International Academy in France awarded Aleppo its culinary prize a few years ago. Thanks, but Aleppo was a food capital long before Paris. Aleppo's diverse communities, Arabs, Kurds, Armenians, Circassians, a sizable Christian population, all contributed food traditions since Aleppo was part of the Ottoman Empire, says Antaki.
The Sultan of Istanbul would send his chef to Aleppo to spy, to see what the caravans are bringing, what's new that he doesn't know.
The Turks are here again, this time as tourists. Turkey and Syria lifted visa restrictions in September. There's been a flood of cross-border trade. Restaurant owners now speak some Turkish and English for Western tourists who come on gourmet tours. But the test of any city's food culture is in the small traditional shops. This one, known as Abu Abdo, specializes in ful, a typical breakfast meal, fava bean soup with a splash of olive oil, lemon juice, and Aleppo's red peppers. A family business owned for more than 70 years, the owner ladles the ful into plastic bags for the to-go crowd, workers as well as businessmen, because it's the best in town.
Abu Abdo. The name, now it becomes a kind of trademark for the ful in Aleppo.
Samir Akkad, a native of the city, says the food culture is easy to explain.
In Aleppo, we like our stomach. We like good food, rich of fat and, you know, kibbeh.
Kibbeh? Anybody who's ever eaten in the Middle East knows kibbeh, a deep-fried oval of cracked wheat with ground meat inside, often greasy and tasteless. In the hands of Aleppo's chefs, kibbeh is an art form, and the artists are finally being rewarded. Syria is opening up its economy after decades of state control, which has revived restaurants and created stars in the kitchen, says Pierre Antaki.
The demand was high. The promotion was fast. A chef today gets 10, 15 folds what a chef would get 10 years ago.
On most nights, Serious eaters gather here, in a dining hall above a hotel. This is a private food club with 600 local members. Their prosperity is on display on the coat rack, mostly mink. This club is known for bridge games, birthday celebrations, and a long menu.
Here, our food is very, very good, and always it's the best in town.
Lucienne Saloum says she misses the food whenever she's away from home.
It's made of very different ingredients. We are using everything that we can find. Yes, very complex.
This treasured cuisine is opening Syria to more extensive tourism, says Antaki.
Slowly, slowly, we have had groups of people coming just to taste the food and see some stones, but their main purpose was to enjoy some good meals.
And when it comes to opening the economy and the country, it turns out that food is a better draw than ancient history.
I'm making a story about Aleppo food. I'm going to eat this tonight.
Aleppo food is great.
Deborah Amos, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.